Okay, are we ready? I think we are. I'm so delighted to be here. Happy New Year. I know it's the end of January, but it's the beginning of the year. Happy New Year. And I had this little kerfuffle earlier when my power went out again. Again, we've had lots of that. And you may or may not know, I'm calling in from my home, which is in McKinleyville, California, about 300 miles north of Marin on the coast in the Redwoods. And, like many, we've had unbelievable amounts of rain. But more difficult for me is the wind. The wind feels very discombobulating to me. And the wind was up today, and that was why the power went out. And that feeling of discombobulation, it reminds me of in the Milwaukee airport, after you go through security, there's a big sign after you take your shoes off and your stuff and you have to put yourself back together. It says recombobulation area. Isn't that a great word? And the history is that it's a totally made-up word by the director of the Milwaukee airport. And he wanted to put some levity into this whole process of taking oneself apart and putting oneself back together in what is, it's sort of fundamentally an unpleasant experience. So when the power came back on, and I knew I was going to get to be here and I was going to get to be here on time, I felt this sense as we were meditating together of recombobulation. And it was just a delight. I was sitting here in my chair, the lights are on, the heat is on, I can see everybody. And I think our practice, in some ways, is a practice of recombobulating. And so it's just very sweet to be here. And I'm glad that it worked. And for me, that the proof is in the pudding that sitting quietly is so healing, right? It just re-regulates the nervous system, takes all of the static, doesn't take all the static. It can take a lot of the static and just help it come back to place. And when I wrote to Mary and Bill when the power was out and I was having a little bit of stress about that, I had said to them that my plan tonight was to talk about how to make peace with dukkha. And so it is sort of always the topic, right? Isn't that the, I mean, maybe there's just one topic. It's making peace with dukkha. So what I want to talk about tonight is are some teachings that have been particularly important for me. And through my practice, I ask myself, what are the things that keep coming back to me, or what are the teachings specifically from the Buddha that have made a big difference in my life? And I think you'll probably recognize these, but I just want to talk about this tonight. In many of the classical teachings or in the texts, oftentimes when somebody is quoting the Buddha or referring to what the Buddha taught, the sutta might start with, "Thus have I heard." Are you familiar with that? "Thus have I heard." And when you hear, "Thus have I heard," when I hear, "Thus have I heard," it kind of makes me perk up, like, oh, listen up, listen up. You want to hear this. So here are the teachings that have been very important for me. Beginning with the big overall umbrella teaching of I teach suffering and the end of suffering, making peace with dukkha, right? That's the big overarching teaching is we understand dukkha is true, dukkha is part of everything, and how do we work with that? The next one, the Buddha famously said, you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. You can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. When I first heard that, I thought, wow, is that actually true? Can I trust that? And I knew pretty early on that, yeah, I could. It was so beautiful and such a powerful invitation. And the next one, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. And you can swap out the word protect for care. By caring for myself, I'm caring for others. By caring for others, I'm caring for myself. The next one, that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. It's just so logical. That which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Where we place our attention is where our energy goes. So we get to choose. Where do you want to be? Where do you want your attention to be? And then the one that has really kept me in this practice is this teaching of the Kalama Sutta. This teaching of Ehipasiko, come and find out for yourself. So you might know this sutta. At the time of the Buddha, there were many itinerant teachers in North India, and they go from community to community to community. And the way I understand this teaching is that when the Buddha came to the Kalamas, a community, they said to him, you know, so many different teachers come through here and tell us what they think is the right way to live. Why should we believe you? What are you going to tell us that's different? And he said, don't believe me. Find out for yourself. Find out for yourself what leads to greed and ill will and delusion, and don't do it. And find out for yourself what leads to non-greed, non-ill will, non-delusion or clarity, and do that. And what's so brilliant about find out for yourself is that there's such inherent trust that we can do this, that you don't have to be a this or a that or belong to this or that, be a card-carrying member of anything to train the mind towards steadiness and clarity, the heart towards kindness, to make a dedication to non-harming and the study of non-harming in an ongoing way. And when anybody has said to me in my life, go find out for yourself, I know you can do this, that's buoyed me up. Somebody else believes in me. The confidence that I might not have, I can get from somebody else who says, this has worked for me, see what you think. So those teachings of understanding suffering and the end of suffering, the inherent goodness and importance of developing self-compassion, kindness, knowing that to love oneself is right, knowing that caring for myself is fundamentally caring for you and vice versa, because of our undeniable interconnection, that what I choose to pay attention to is my life, because I only have right now, and that I can take on this study of what leads to non-greed, non-ill will, and this clear mind. So those have been very profound teachings, and they're fundamental, right? They're very, very basic. There's nothing esoteric about it. That's the other thing I love about this practice, is it's logical. It's very commonsensical. Because of this, that. Because of that, this. We can count on those kinds of ripple effects. We don't necessarily know where they're all going, but we do know that everything is certainly connected. So from there, if we look at I teach suffering and the end of suffering, I want to talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths. And it's always a good time to go back to basics. Barbara and Bill, I'm so glad you're going to be doing this, Because how many times have we all heard these same things? And sometimes it just goes right over. Sometimes we fall asleep. But I think mostly what happens is there's another way we hear it. It goes in maybe a little bit differently. And there's a reassurance that, oh yeah, this is important. This is really good. So we know the classical recitation of the truths. Life includes dukkha. Sometimes it's life is dukkha, but I choose not to go with that translation because life is more than dukkha. But life includes dukkha, that friction of not quite rightness, stress, challenge, difficulty. There's a cause of the dukkha, which is our clinging, our grasping, our insistence that things be a certain way. And it's painful when we are pushing away the truth of how things are. Or as Sylvia Boorstein says, suffering is the imperative in the mind that things be other than they are. Such a great definition. Because imperative, anytime there's an imperative about a certain view, that's dukkha. Or we could say pain plus resistance equals suffering. That comes from Shinzen Young, a teacher in Los Angeles. But there's an end to suffering. Suffering can end. Peace is possible. And this is the place that I think is critical in our practice, is the shift from the second noble truth to the third noble truth. There is the cause of suffering, and there is an end of suffering. And when I think about the end of suffering, I mean like in the moment. The moment the mind subsides, the moment we loosen the grip and can say, yeah, it's like this right now. That's how it is. And we don't have to be in contention with the conditions of our lives, even if they are unpleasant. But this practice is teaching us and carrying us over and over into this experience of, this is how it is. And there's a path leading to the end of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. And my guess is that many of you are familiar with how Tony Bernhardt has reinterpreted the Four Noble Truths. Tony Bernhardt is a teacher in Davis. And for many years, he worked at Folsom State Prison with some of the people who were in prison for life and people who'd been imprisoned for very dangerous crimes. And they would come to him in a cage. And he was teaching. He was teaching the Buddha Dharma, but in a secular way. And so what he said to these tough men, shit happens. We tend to make it worse. We don't have to. And here's how. You know, that's so straightforward, isn't it? Because we do tend to make it worse, and we don't have to. And that's the choice point. That's the piece of why mindful awareness is so critical. Because when we can shift from the automatic, defended, unpracticed default response of reactivity and know it's happening and be able to shift it to responsiveness. Oh, I don't have to make a difficult thing more difficult. That's the freedom right there. That is the freedom. And it takes attentiveness. It takes care. It takes patience. It takes that willingness to pause. You know, that very famous quote from Viktor Frankl, in between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose. Because it's true. Anytime you have ever had the experience, and I imagine you all have, when you didn't fire off the next snarky remark, you're just like, hold it. I'm not going to do that. That's the moment when we don't make it worse. And the here's how, there's a path leading to the end of suffering, and here's how. The Noble Eightfold Path. I think that within the Eightfold Path is everything, all of our practices. So choose your practice that is most accessible for you, that keeps you steady, that keeps your mind clear, and you have access to your heart. Sometimes it's metta practice. Sometimes it's equanimity practice. Sometimes it's staying in the body. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, or the practices of Vedana. Oh, pleasant. Oh, unpleasant, or the absence of pleasant and unpleasant. But another way that I want to offer about looking at these Four Noble Truths comes from Stephen Batchelor. Anybody familiar with his interpretation of looking? It's pretty cool. So here it is. So Stephen Batchelor, you know, wonderful teacher, former Tibetan monk, who's done a huge amount of work and within Buddhism, looking at secular practice. And he has reinterpreted the Four Noble Truths as the fourfold task. Teachings about dukkha, truths not to be believed. And this is where he brings that beautiful Kalama Sutta in, the Ehi Pasiko. Not to be believed, but as injunctions to transform our lives, to support our flourishing. So what he says is, first noble truth, embrace life. Acknowledge and deeply understand the human condition, especially its inevitable difficulties. That's what this is saying. And he uses the word reactivity synonymously with suffering. So he says, let reactivity be. All right, so that grippiness, that clutching, that insistence that things be other than they are, when you feel that, can you let that be? Just watch it. That's not making it worse. Or that's, you know, watching the tendency to make it worse. And then he says, for the third noble truth, the third task, see reactivity stop. Experience this profound peace of mind that comes from this letting go. So in the meditation, when I offered the invitation to notice, where was there some stillness? Where was there some ease, some relaxation, some peace? And to get close to that, that is, if that happened for you, that's a moment where there were no problems. You know, in that moment, things were okay. And to experience okayness is an experience of contentedness, which is happiness, which is ease, which is peace. And it goes deep. It's so supportive. And then for the here's how, and there's a path leading to the end of suffering, Stephen Batchelor says, actualize a path. Respond, say, see, set a direction, cultivate a path in which we work with all of these aspects of our lives, wise view, intention, speech, action, effort, livelihood, mindfulness, concentration, or the collectedness of the mind. And I love how he talks about each of these aspects of the path. Instead of wise or right, he uses the word complete, which is quite beautiful, because my understanding of the Pali word sama means completion, maturation, a summation. And it's gotten translated as right view, wise view. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You can find your own way with it, but I really appreciate that he talks about this as complete. There's a maturity to it, a depth of wisdom and understanding. So knowing that we are not being asked to just believe rules, but this is an alive practice, an alive methodology, you could call it, the fourfold task to truly embrace your life, turning towards the truth of dukkha. Let the reactivity be. Notice what it stimulates inside of you. Right? That there's a cause of this suffering, that we tend to make it worse. And then don't act on that. Pause, wait, stop, sense in. And watch it shift and change. Know the moment when your mind subsides from these imperatives. That is a delicious moment, right? You know, right when you can say, I don't have to fight this. This is how it is. That's freedom. I think that's freedom right there. And then work the path. Work the path. Choose the practices that work for you. Study them. And know that this isn't necessarily linear. You know, we're not going to, it's not going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But it is a positive feedback loop. And so you can practice with that. When you have the experience of the mind subsiding, letting go, letting be, it tells the body, it tells the mind and the heart, oh, this is possible. I don't have to be in an argument here. I don't have to be in contention with the conditions of my life. They're just the conditions of my life. And you can make shifts and changes to those conditions to a degree. And then there's a whole bunch we don't have control over. I remember one time I was meeting with James Barras, and he said, Heidi, struggle is extra. Struggle is extra. It is. It is. So choose your extras. You know, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. So the other thing that's happening for me in my own practice that I'm noticing quite frequently, in addition to coming back to these teachings that have been so important for me, so instructive and informative, are three other questions to apply to whatever it is that I'm learning, and I offer them to you for whatever it is you're learning as you practice. The first one is, whatever it is that you're studying, how do you understand it? How do you understand dukkha? Or how do you understand generosity or some of the paramis or any of them? And that's one question, because that's pretty conceptual. That's how you understand it. But what we want is for these practices to come alive. And then for them to come alive, they need to be embodied. So how do you experience dukkha? How do you experience the Brahmaviharas? How do you experience any of the paramis? Notice what that is like inside of you when any of those energies are present, when any of those teachings are useful to you. Try to get it out of the mind. Trust that you understand them. And drop it into your body and see how it works in a practical way in your life. And then the third question, this is also very important. Why does it matter? What is the point here? And I don't mean, oh, who cares? Why does it matter? I don't mean it in that way at all. I mean, how do I understand a teaching? How do I experience it? And what is this teaching about? Why does it matter? And I don't know if this is true for you, but it's certainly true for me that sometimes teachings just go right by. Like, have you ever heard a teaching or an instruction over and over again, and it becomes rote? You just hear it. And there are times that we are ready for a teaching. There are times where we're working on something else, that we really might be working metta practice, and the teachings on impermanence are, yeah, I get it. Everything is changing, but we're not really diving into it, which is fine. You don't have to. You do this study and this practice as it comes to you. But I think it becomes alive when, for me, it does, when I can answer the question, why does it matter? And I don't know is an appropriate answer. But to know that the Buddha gave, thus have I heard, the Buddha gave teachings that were timeless, important, all of those things, profound. But we don't have to get everything all the time, you know. Get what you get and trust that you'll keep going. I remember how many years, my guess is you've heard this for many years too, as a meditation instruction, rest in awareness. Rest in awareness. Anybody been heard that like 5,000 times? For so long, it just went over me. I didn't know what that meant. All right, fine. I'm just going to sit here and do my meditation practice. And a couple years ago, I had one of those aha moments where I realized I could stop working so hard and I could rest. Like, oh, rest in awareness. Can I just settle? Can I just be here? And that is that instruction from Ajahn Amaro. Let the mind and body assume the natural ease and peace that is the natural ease and peace of the mind and body. Because that's true. That is inside of us. And of course, it gets covered over by all kinds of things. But those moments when we can truly rest in the awareness of whatever is here and not have to fix it or change it, but just be in it, that's a beautiful moment. That's a place of non-contention. So, lastly, I was sitting a retreat a few years ago, and I had this, I was just resting in awareness, just being in this cabin by myself for a week or so. And I got these thoughts or this insight, I just think it was just an insight on this is what I need to do in my life, in my practice. Three things: dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. Dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. And I remember thinking, oh, thanks, that is a tall order. And it is a tall order. And I don't know who I was saying thank you to, but, you know, thank you to this practice, to this awareness. So to dissolve contention is really big, but, and it takes strength and steadiness and courage and confidence and faith. We talked about faith, I think, last time I was here. And we just take the next step. We just step into it. Martin Luther King said, faith is taking the first step even when you can't see the whole staircase. You know, faith is taking the first step even when you can't see the whole staircase. So, you know, there are, how many of us around the globe have been coming to this practice for many, many years, over and over and over again, because there's something we know is good that is happening here. Something is happening. And for me, I think it is working with the first, second, and third noble truths about the truth of contention, that it's painful, that I don't want to make it worse, that I really want to be present in my life, however it is, with as much kindness as I can, with a commitment to non-harming. And it's going to take my whole life and the next one, or who knows? So what does it take to not be in contention with the conditions of our lives? We can pick up some of the well-known adages. It's not what I wanted, but it's what I've got. That helps give a little perspective, a little equanimity. Any kind of reminder that says, oh yeah, right, it's like this. This is how this works. Shinzen Yang, teacher in LA, he says, do not fight with yourself at any level. Do not fight with yourself at any level. It's a beautiful thing. How many times do we reject aspects of ourselves? And I need this teaching that says you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself, because that shifts my internal from ways in which I might find myself not quite right, the inner critic, to I don't want to fight with myself anymore. I really don't. And I mostly don't. But I need this practice of dissolving contention, of understanding that self-compassion is so profoundly important and fundamental. We could go on and on and on, but this whole discussion of the Four Noble Truths and the Fourfold Tasks is all about dissolving contention, which naturally leads to this depth of understanding of interconnection and impermanence. We are all connected. Everything is changing. Dukkha is true for everybody. So forgive everybody. Start to understand that everybody is struggling with whatever they're struggling. All of us here, I would bet, have known despair, painful despair. And hopefully we've all also known a lot of joy. And so we don't have to know each other's stories to know how much we're the same and connected. And I'm not, when I say forgive everyone, I'm not condoning harmful behavior that you may have received. You don't have to like somebody. You don't have to be in a relationship. But you don't have to hold the hot ball and chain around your leg that keeps you stuck from old grudges. And this is also a huge practice, and this is where we have the practices of the Brahmaviharas to help lead with the heart, to help incline the heart towards kindness and friendliness, and to not cause harm to ourselves by holding grudges. Because we are the first and foremost primary recipient of our own actions. So when I'm holding on grudge, any amount of ill will, it's really hurting me, nobody else. So I don't want to do that. Angel Kyoto Williams, Rev Angel, she says, for us to transform as a society, we have to allow ourselves to be transformed as individuals. And for us to be transformed, we have to allow for the incompleteness of any of our truths and a real forgiveness for the complexity of human beings. The incompleteness, the difficulty of the human condition. And that's when the forgiveness can arise. We're all just trying to be okay. And wake up. Wake up. Stick with these practices of awareness, of presence, of compassion and wisdom. And just keep doing it. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, just do two things. Begin and keep going. Begin and keep going. That's pretty sweet. And the very last thing, and then we'll stop, is from Sayadaw Utejaniya, beautiful monastic teacher who died a couple of years ago. In his teachings on joy, what he says is you should feel happy when you know or understand anything. You should be happy when you know or understand anything. And this is the kind of understanding, the way I relate to this teaching is that these are moments of awakening when I go from the lowercase, yeah, I kind of get it, the lowercase g to, oh, I get it, bigger g, uppercase g, I get it. These understandings that come, that change us, that shift deeply how we relate to our lives and each other's lives. And be happy about that. You should be happy when you know or understand anything, the aha moment. Those are beautiful moments. So I think we can trust the Four Noble Truths in whatever iteration speaks to you. And I do think we need to dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. And we do it together. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your kind attention. It's good to be here with you. And let's talk with each other. Any comments, questions, reflections, additions?
Well, you just covered a whole bunch of stuff in our course.
Yeah, hey, you want to come with us and tell you?
That was a lot, wasn't it?
Yeah, you really managed to put a lot of information into that talk. I had one thing that occurred to me. This is not really relevant, but it's about the thus have I heard. That always gives me a chill because my understanding is that's Ananda.
I think that's right.
Reciting yeah. to the council what he has heard the Buddha say. And so it, to me, that's sort of like the reality of that transmission. It makes it much more visceral to imagine this guy whose words we hear 2,500 years later.
I'm with you, Bill. I agree. And it wakes me up. Oh, thus I have heard. Like, okay, sit up and listen. Yeah. It is an injunction. Yeah, Deborah.
Oh, first of all, that was just mesmerizing. Thank you. And although I agree with Bill that you put an awful lot into that talk, it was in such, I don't know how to say this, biteable pieces, absorbable pieces. I'm going to listen to your talk again and again
Thank you.
And take notes this time. I just wanted to say that what I've been doing lately is sending metta to my reactivity.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
I just started doing this. Instead of just, you know, wishing myself well and wishing other people may they be well, even if I don't like you, I hope you're well. But recently I just started sending metta to my reactivity. Oh, you poor thing. I know you're there trying to help me or protect me. I'm so sorry. You know, and so the phrase that you're using, dissolve contention, is perfect.
Oh,
it's
good.
Definitely. It's just totally what that is meant to do. I just didn't have that wording. So thank you for that. It's going up on the kitchen cupboard.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad. You know, because I think it's literally how I experience it, because it slowly dissolves and then it reforms and something else gets added. And it's a continual process.
I was sort of beating myself up when I couldn't, not beating myself up, but being disappointed that I couldn't be more genuinely loving to somebody who really has been not so wonderful. And I'm trying to send them metta and wish them well. And I do wish them well. I don't wish anybody harm, but my heart wasn't in it. It was just sort of rote. But this dissolving contention, you know, giving my reactivity some love is exactly, you know, when we carry that stuff around, it's, you know, my blood pressure that suffers, or my cholesterol that goes up.
Yeah. So, you know, to your point about sending your own reactivity, the metta, without a doubt, because, you know, we're animal bodies, you know, we have all this stuff going on, and there is dukkha, period. And so if we can send some love to the dukkha itself, it softens it. Thank you, Deborah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Corey. I really appreciate that translation to complete view.
Isn't that cool?
I've always had a little reaction to the word right view, right this, right that. And like, oh, if it's a possible, what is it? You know, it just seemed like, I don't know if it's just, but for me personally, there's always been a little reaction. And then that idea of just acknowledging the incompleteness of our truths.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Yeah. It just takes away any kind of immediately. And it's just like, oh, it just is. It's not that there is no truth in what somebody says that I don't agree with. It's the incomplete. I love those. So that's, Where did you hear this?
That's Angel Kyoto Williams, Rev Angel. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, check
her out. She's a badass.
Yeah.
Say it like that. She's super smart, super clear. She pulls no punches, and she's a beautiful teacher. You know, she's such a learned, wise teacher. Let me read that to you again. For us to transform as a society, we have to allow ourselves to be transformed as individuals, right? That's what we're doing. This is deeply transformative work that we do individually and together. And for us to be transformed, we have to allow for the incompleteness of any of our truths. So we can get it wrong. We don't have to be all right. You know, we are in the process of becoming. And a real forgiveness for the complexity of human beings. It is hard to be a person.
So much empathy there. I have a quick question for you. Yeah. What would be the opposite of inner critic?
Let's talk about that. What's the opposite of the inner critic would be, you know what comes to me immediately? The grandmother voice.
Okay.
You know, the grandmother who's seen it all and says, oh, of course, honey. Mm-hmm. Of course it feels like that. It'll change. I love you anyway. It's okay. Self-compassion, right? That Liz says. Yes. Yeah, so the inner critic, the opposite of the inner critic is the one who loves us dearly, who says, yeah, I know. I get it.
Thank you.
No, I mean, wait, who else? Who was waiting? Did I miss somebody? I think we need to move. Is there anything else? Because I think we need to move into our Liz. Yes, there you go.
I love A.E. Postol. And I quote that a lot. And I love that the Buddha says, don't even believe me.
Yep.
You are the final authority. And I love that.
Me too.
I love that. It makes us very responsible. But also, we are the final authority for our actions and what we believe.
Completely.
Yeah.
Have you heard the expression? I think I first heard it from Wes Nisker, when he says, you are not your fault. This is great. You are not your fault, but you are responsible for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, so this goes to Corey's point. You know, we're incomplete. We're learning. We're going to mess up. And we come with a whole lot of conditioning.
Of course.
But we are responsible for what we do and how we are. And this is a practice that, taken seriously, and I think all of us do because we wouldn't be here, is saying, okay, take responsibility for your mind and for your heart and how you behave, because it is up to you.
Yes.
Yeah,
Thank you. It is
up to you. Such a pleasure to be with you. I'm all recombobulated now.